Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with Reluctant Therapist. Happy Tuesday and Happy New Year, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday and Happy New Year, Hank.
I'm freezing. Bree just gave a little weather checkup, and it's like 58 degrees, but that's outside. In here, it's a chilly 52, I think.
Well, I think that it's good to, you know, battle the elements every now and then because it reminds us that we are resilient and that we can overcome any obstacles put in our way if we just put our mind to it and keep breathing.
Well, plus I look at the headlines and see where it's like 2 degrees in Fargo, and I just feel like kind of a wimp.
Well, exactly. I mean, our ability to withstand much as far as weather is pretty low. But it's a good segue in today's topic because we're going to talk about the role of therapy and psychotherapy and resilience and healing and growth and change in our lives. Because last week, the show topic was kind of a call out to ideas for topics or interests or issues that might be interesting to you in the coming year in 2017. And I have a list of the most common things that people ask me, either on the air or through emails or however they contact me. And the first one always is, why am I the reluctant therapist? Why the reluctance in the title? Which is a fair question to ask. The other question most common is, do I still do a private practice? And the third most common question is, how do I find a good therapist for myself if I'm looking? So it seemed like today would be a good day with the new year and a lot of people thinking about their life, reflecting on where they're going or where they've been, that we should take some time to talk about the world of psychotherapy. And if you are thinking about stepping into that world or venturing into some sort of counseling, what are those steps that you should take or what are those things that you should look for to help you navigate what can be, I think, incredibly complicated? Therapy is not a one issue subject. There is not one clinician that does the same kind of work for all people. There isn't one kind of therapy that all clinicians do. I think it's incredibly overwhelming. And I think one of my greatest concerns is that we tend to, which makes sense, you know, if you're searching for a car dealer or a doctor, you know, or plastic surgery or some sort of hair, you know, dresser, you want to find the person who's the best. And usually our thought is the person with the most training and the highest, price tag is going to give us the best service or give us the best treatment. But in the world of counseling, that's not necessarily true. Those with the highest level of education aren't necessarily going to be the best clinician for treating the most common things that bring people into therapy. And so unlike, you know, shopping for a restaurant or a hotel or a new car, shopping for a clinician or a therapist or a counselor to work with is a different mindset that just looking for the person with the most education and the highest bill rate. So we're going to talk about that. I'm also curious to know what your experience with counseling or therapy has been. Has it been a positive experience? Have you had a negative experience? What went on for you? What would you have liked to have done differently? Or what did you find helpful about counseling? Because I also think that talking about our experiences with therapy really help other people know what they're looking for, know what they can expect. Because unless you live in this world like I do, I think it's hard to know what you can actually expect from your counseling experience or your therapist. So I'm going to try to cover all those things, but I'm going to count on you to kind of direct where we go because I have a lot of knowledge about this subject that's more than probably an hour's worth of information. So I'm curious to know what it is you'd like to know about therapy or therapists or different types of theoretical orientation and what to look for. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. You can also find more information about the show on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. One of my 2017 goals is to be better about our Instagram account and try to keep current with that, The Reluctant Therapist on Instagram. We also have our podcasts available through iTunes, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. If you search that through your iTunes app or your podcast app, you can hit subscribe and get our shows uploaded every week. And I appreciate Bree now kind of catching us up so that our shows are current, so you'll have them all downloaded. And you can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, and all of our shows are also listed there by topic. So there's a lot of ways to get in touch, and you can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and I'm always happy to hear from you and hear what's going on in your life. So here we are, entering into the new year, and it's interesting because I teach a course called An Introduction to the Counseling Profession, Counseling Clinical Profession. And it's a class that's usually taken by students who are considering or exploring the possibility of going into the field of psychotherapy as a possible profession. Because that's what most students are doing at college, is kind of trying to figure out what that path is going to be that they'll take through their work life, through their career, trying to explore different avenues, different options. And I understand that. I think it's really important. And I think having an opportunity to get an overview of the counseling profession is incredibly important if you're thinking that that's a place you'd like to work. Because the umbrella of the counseling profession, the helping profession, on one end has psychiatry, and on the far end has peer counseling. And in between, you have everything from life coaching to drug and alcohol counselors, to licensed clinical social workers, to marriage and family therapists, to pastoral counselors, to clinical psychologists and child psychologists and school psychologists, and psychiatric nurses and nurse practitioners. I mean, there are a lot of different helping professions under the umbrella of counseling or in the field of psychology. And so they come to this class, wanting to find out more about the opportunities to utilize their psychology degrees in some way, and to see what might, interest them. But I take a lot of flack in that class because I am hard on my students. I really want to push them to understand what draws them to this kind of work. What makes them think this is something that they would be good at? Why do they think that they would be effective clinicians? And so I spend, the first part of the quarter talking about all the different fields and what counseling looks like, and how therapy works, and all the different developmental stages and all the different theoretical orientations. But then the second half of the quarter, we talk mostly about what are those personal dynamics, those personal tendencies, the temperaments that are so important in making someone or helping someone develop into an effective clinician. And so the students will push back and say, you make me feel like we're all going to be lousy at being therapists, or, we're going to all stink at this work, or that, no therapy is good therapy. And I'm not trying to make them feel like they're going to be terrible therapists, but I am pretty clear, and maybe it's that reluctance, that definition of the reluctant therapist, in that there are probably more people doing substandard to okay average work in the helping profession than those that are doing really helpful, excellent work. And that should be a concern, because we are licensing professionals on a regular basis. We're kind of churning them out through these different schools of therapy, different counseling schools, different master's programs and doctoral programs, and different licensing and sending people out to do this work. But I think our oversight, or even our direction or our understanding of mental health, is so diverse and so diffuse that it's very difficult to ensure that the people that are going into this work and practicing are practicing in ways that are actually helpful to those that are coming in to seek treatment. The oversight is not as intense as you would kind of hope it would be when it comes to treating people for mental health concerns. And it's not because the clinicians or the people going into the work are intending to do poor work, that the intention is always wonderful. Most of my students will say, I'm a good listener, or people come to me with their problems, or I want to be of help to other people, or I really care about people, I have a lot of compassion, or I've struggled with my own mental health issues or with family issues, and I, you know, want to help other people who are struggling with the same issues. All of the intentions to go into the work are usually very good. The struggle is, what is the path from that good intention to actually sitting with and working with an individual or a family to help them overcome their issues? And that's where we have that wide range, wide variability in training that makes it really hard to have a unified helping profession of good quality helping professionals. So I'm going to try not to stay on the negative. I'm actually going to try to go positive for my for most of the show, all of the ways that you can actually have a positive experience, because I think it's really important. I still believe very strongly in the role of talk therapy and therapy, psychotherapy in our lives and helping to maintain good mental health and well-being. I'm a huge proponent. The reluctance in me, the reluctant therapist, was born from what I saw change over the 25 years of doing this work, from going through my own counseling training in kind of this sense of deep, soulful, introspective work based around talk therapy and this adept psychological approach of helping people really kind of know their psyche and their unconscious and doing this almost spiritual work of healing those things that we most struggle with. That the training that I received 25 years ago, I watched it kind of slip away as the insurance companies stepped in and started limiting the amount of sessions that clients could have down to 8 or 10 sessions, and started to limit what they were going to cover and forcing therapists to diagnose clients with different mental health issues or disorders or illnesses that would stay with them as part of their medical records for life when they really were just normal life transitions that they were going through. So I saw this shift happen underneath me from kind of being a person, human-centered practice to almost a consumerist-based, insurance-driven medical model way of looking at mental health, where we were just treating symptoms and shipping people back out into the world without really helping them come to a place of wholeness. And so I started to feel this reluctance and wanting to be a part of something or be associated with something that I felt was really not helping people to heal and grow and achieve some sort of balance or wellness, but really was just kind of putting on band-aids or symptom management for issues that really were not psychological disorders, but more normal reactions to life transitions. So I take the flack from my students because I tell them that I see this work, this profession, is more of a calling or a commission or a service or a summons, a call to duty, than really a path to employment. In some ways, I think if there's other things you're interested in doing, do them, because the work of the counselor, the work of the therapist can be so overwhelming and so draining and so taxing that unless you really have an incredible, hearty sense of who you are, or this very strong base, or this incredible ability for self-care, or an ability to kind of step back and maintain some distance between yourself and your clients, to still have empathy and hold that space but not become sympathetic and immersed in your client's world, unless you have that capacity on a really incredible level, this work can be really overwhelming. It can take you down. Social workers have about an 18-month shelf life, which means for social workers that go into the field, they quite often really feel motivated to help others and lift them up and give them better opportunities. But it's so draining, getting so involved and so intensely invested in their clients, that it can suck their own life out of them. So I send the cautionary tale to my students that are interested in doing this work about what it really takes to fully invest yourself as a clinician, and also that it requires so much personal growth and constant personal awareness and exploration and self-care and, you know, some sort of your own spiritual practice. It takes constant work to maintain your own readiness as a therapist, as well as, you know, keeping current with different techniques or different tools that are out there. And more importantly, I send the cautionary tale to my students, the prospective therapists, that although the trend right now seems to be around, you know, packing our students' suitcases full of tools they can use as therapists, tools are not therapy. And there can be a million interventions, you know, homeworks and journaling and thought stopping and meditation. There's a million tools that we can use as therapists to help clients, but tools aren't therapy. Therapy itself really comes from the relationship that is developed between the clinician and the client. That ultimately what's really healing, and that's no matter what therapist you go to, what their training is, what their theoretical orientation is, true healing takes place in that space between the therapist and the client. So if you do nothing else in your search for a therapist, you really owe it to yourself to find someone that you have chemistry with. That same chemistry almost in choosing who your friends will be or who you're going to date or who you're going to spend time with. To not be wowed by someone's degree or education or their fancy speak or their promises of healing, but to really pay attention to your gut and to sense if you feel connected to this person, if you feel safe with them, if you feel you can trust them with your story and with your soul. That will be your best opportunity for growth. And interestingly enough, that first step in finding a clinician that you have chemistry with is actually one of your great first steps towards healing. Because when we start to listen to our gut and we trust our gut and trust that what we're feeling is something that we should respond to or follow when it comes to relationships, when it comes to meeting other people, when we can trust how we feel and know that our instincts are correct, that first decision, who it is you're going to pay to tell your story to, is one of your biggest first steps into healing. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And today we're talking about that path through the psychotherapeutic world. And if you're thinking about going to therapy, how do you find the best clinician, and how do you determine what kind of therapy it is you want to do? So I thought I'd talk a little bit about the different schools of therapy, the different licenses that exist, and some of the different interventions that we do. But I'd really like to hear from you, because I'm curious to know what your experience has been with therapy. I mean, you listen to me week after week. I come to this work from the space of the reluctant therapist. I have a lot of concerns about the work we're doing on a regular basis, whether or not we really are as a profession helping those that are struggling, or if we aren't inadvertently causing more problems, creating greater harm, setting people back because we don't have a uniformed way of practicing or viewing mental health. You know, part of our profession views mental health as a medical disease that needs to be treated like a sickness, like diabetes or like cancer, and that medications and symptoms and diagnosis are the first things that we pay attention to. Part of our profession really looks at the spiritual void and the existential crises and the normal transitions of life, dealing with grief and loss and growth and relationships. And part of our profession looks at kind of a mix of the two, the brain science, the neurological, and the empirical research, along with kind of that spiritual sense. But where will you find yourself in all of that? Who will you sit with and feel comfortable telling your story to? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. What has been your experience with counseling, good or bad? What would you have liked it to have been like? Is there something about it that was really helpful or something about it that wasn't at all? And if you have any questions about your own search for a counselor or a therapist, I'm happy to talk about that as well. 805-781-3875. So I'm going to start off with the different licenses because that's kind of the first question that comes up. Who do I go see? And as I mentioned earlier, you know, there's this large umbrella of the world of psychotherapy or counseling. And on one end, you have the psychiatrists. And the psychiatrists are MDs. They're trained to diagnose with a medical background, do diagnosis, do treatment of mental and emotional crises. Psychiatrists today rarely do any sort of psychotherapy. That's not really part of the mainstay of psychiatry. It's very much about medical evaluations and medications. Underneath also who can prescribe medications are child psychiatrists who have special training when it comes to the treatment of emotional and behavioral problems for children. We have psychiatric nurse practitioners and our primary care physicians who actually are the largest source of mental health prescriptions of any of the prescribing practitioners. And so you really want to make sure that if you're seeing your primary care physician for anxiety or depression or some sort of medication, that you're working in tandem with a mental health professional to make sure that you're getting complete care, because primary care physicians aren't necessarily trained to work with mental health concerns. There's also physician's assistants or nurse practitioners that can prescribe medications under the license of a psychiatrist. So after the psychiatrist, we have the psychologists. And psychologists also have a doctoral degree, but they don't write prescriptions, but they do psychiatric evaluations or assessments, and they also are trained to do diagnosis and treatment, do counseling, individual or group, or family counseling. And there are child psychologists that are trained to work with primarily issues of childhood. There are school psychologists that have special training in dealing with the education system. And so the psychologist brings, you know, a more focused training on actual psychiatric evaluations or psychological evaluations. And then under the master's degrees, you have the marriage and family therapist, which is the work, the training I have as a marriage and family counselor. My master's is in counseling psychology. There's also licensed clinical social workers who are trained to do counseling with individuals, but also to do the social work of helping people to access those needs of daily living, like housing and medical help and life skills. There are licensed professional counselors. There's pastoral counselors. And there's also people who are lay counselors who do peer counseling. There's drug and alcohol counselors who can be certified to do work in drug and alcohol counseling. And so it's important to understand first and foremost, before you contact any clinician, is what is it you're concerned with? What is the issue that you want to address? And that will first help you direct yourself to who you would want to contact. If you're having a severe psychiatric break or severe psychiatric disorder, hallucinations, schizophrenia, you know, you want a medical evaluation for that. You would probably want to go to a psychiatrist. But for life skills or tasks of daily living, relationships, marriage, parenting, transitions, grief, new jobs, personal growth, then you're looking at psychologists, marriage and family therapists, licensed clinical social workers, and anyone under that master's level degree in counseling. And then it will be about someone that you actually relate with well. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. And Megan, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I just want to thank you so much for sharing how important that relationship is and to really encourage people to look for therapists or for counselors with the relationship in mind. Just personal experience, it's a huge part of the healing process. And I think that a lot of times we go into it with, you know, this is what's wrong with me, fix me. And I think we do fail to having the 6 minute connection with. So I so appreciate you really addressing that. And I think it's so needed to educate people on this. Is a huge part of this process is really finding that person that you can really connect with. Because that I agree, is where the healing begins.
Well, and I appreciate that, Megan. And I think one of the challenges in our modern world of psychotherapy, navigating this world, is that insurance has become such a big player in the therapeutic world. So it seems to limit the options that a lot of people have in choosing someone that they want to go see. And I understand that if you are working with your, you know, insurance provider, you have to work from the list that they give you. And then from that list, hopefully, you know, there are websites or information about each counselor or therapist that you can contact. And so to go through this list, it kind of becomes part of your work before you even get any help, is to assess which of the people who are providers through your insurance that you can work with. For some people, they have the opportunity, the privilege to pay for private pay to see therapists. And there are a lot of therapists today that I know that do private pay only, that don't work with insurance companies because they don't want to be limited to the 8 to 10 sessions that insurance companies tend to, only allow. And they don't want to feel limited in the kind of work that they're going to do. So I think that even though all of the research, and I don't care from what part of the counseling profession, all the research and the efficacy of counseling shows that it is primarily the relationship you have with the counselor that is the most healing, because insurance companies are so in charge of accessing mental health services, it makes it very challenging for people to connect with a counselor they feel most closely connected to, or they have, you know, this huge list and they don't even know where to start. So part of the challenge is to kind of think about what it is you're looking for help for, and to start going through the list of counselors that you have available and see what their specialties are. Or if they don't have a website, call them and ask them, what is your specialty? What is your theoretical orientation? What is your licensure? What is your bias and experience? And you have to basically interview all of these therapists until you find someone who is aligned with your worldview before you even step in the door. And if you're in a place of crisis, it makes it really difficult to feel confident enough to interview someone. When we're in crisis, we want to reach out to the closest person that feels like they can be healing. So I think it's maybe something worth considering before you even are in need of a therapist in crisis is that during a life transition time or a period of almost peace in your life, that you do some work kind of seeing which therapy is available to you and what counselors are available, and try to make a more conscious choice instead of having to make a choice under duress. 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, Elizabeth.
Yes.
I am so happy to be on your program. I think your show is great.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have had mostly really positive experiences in psychotherapy, and I'm now in my mid-60s, but I began seeking out therapy when I was in my mid-20s. And I think I was very lucky that the very first therapist I saw, I worked well with him. He used rational emotive therapy, mm-hmm. and it seemed to be what I needed at that point in time. But that was, and as you said earlier, seeking out the therapy really is the beginning of the healing.
Yes.
So that was just the first step. I've been in many different courses of therapy for different reasons, usually around the idea of, you know, unsatisfying relationships. But, you know, sooner or later, I understood that, you know, the one common denominator to all the relationships that I was dissatisfied with was me.
Yeah, and so I'm curious, Maureen, how have you seen, because you've been doing therapy for quite a few years in different decades, have you seen the type of therapy or the availability of therapy or the practice of therapy change over the years for you?
You know, I found that part of what you were saying earlier very interesting, too, because I think that I probably have been extraordinarily fortunate that I was in a course of therapy on and off for about 10 years in my 50s with a woman who just was old school, I guess you want to say, and very eclectic. Mm-hmm. And it was all about the healing relationship between the two of us. And I made a huge amount of progress in that course of therapy. Then when I moved to California, which was a little over 2 years ago, I felt the need for therapy not too long after I got here. And so I asked for a reference from a friend, and I was, again, extremely fortunate, excuse me, to find a woman who was kind of like a contemporary of my other therapist. She was a little bit older than me, kind of old school, eclectic, and I knew immediately that I could work with her. So it was really all about the relationship in both cases. I think that's key.
Well, and it's interesting because both of your experiences were kind of with more the old school traditional talk therapists. And if you don't mind me asking, were they through insurance companies or did you private pay these therapists?
I was lucky that in both cases, the recommendations ended up being people who accepted the insurance that I had. I'm very lucky.
Well, and you are, and it's wonderful that you had such positive experiences. And I'm curious if you, what would be the primary thing you noticed was growth that you experienced through the longer-term therapy? Like, what was the biggest transition or change that you experienced?
I guess the way to bottom line it is saying that I grew into myself.
I love that. Maureen, thank you so much for taking the time to call. And I think that Maureen brings up a very important piece of the whole idea of psychotherapy is that we have to have some understanding of what healing looks like for us. So before you make that phone call, you know, before you go through your list of insurance providers or you ask for a referral, and I think what Maureen mentioned is absolutely key, go word of mouth, talk to friends about therapists or therapists they've seen, because you know, there's a lot of ways that people get information online now and with different reviews and Yelp reviews and scores, but really none of those can substitute for someone's actual experience of working with a therapist and what they're like and what their style is. And so use those word of mouth references. Or if you're using websites, a lot of clinicians now will talk about their orientation or their training or their perspective. I think it's important to understand, you know, how will you know if you are healed? You have to go in kind of having some expectations. I think it's very dangerous to go into therapy saying, I feel broken, fix me, and allowing someone to just kind of take you wherever they feel you need to go. We want to remain in charge of our mental health as best we can, even if we're struggling with anxiety and depression or life transitions, relationship issues, self-improvement, growth, grief, chronic or, you know, severe depression. Even if we are dealing with issues that feel too large to comprehend overcoming, in order to be successful, you have to go into therapy having some sense in your head that healing is possible, that you are capable of healing, that you have within you the possibility for change. Because if you just allow a therapist to kind of have their way with you, you're setting yourself up in some ways for real trouble. So today we're talking about what is counseling and what is effective counseling, and have you had a positive or negative experience with counseling? What was that like for you? 805-781-3875. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio, KCBX, and we'll be back to take your calls.
I'll give a little bit of my love to you. There's so much that we need to share. So send a smile and show you care.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX, and you're invited to be part of this conversation, 805-781-3875. The idea for today's show was really the call that I put out last week for show topic ideas for coming into 2017, and I got a lot of response about how do I go about getting into counseling. I've thought about counseling, I've thought about therapy, but I'm just not sure how to get started. And so I thought today would be a good opportunity with the new year to talk about the different types of therapy that are out there and how to find a therapist, and to also explain a little bit why I am the reluctant therapist and my hesitations in just jumping into any sort of therapy just because it's available to you. But I'm curious to know what your experience has been with therapy, if it's been positive or negative, or if you have any questions about it. Because as I said earlier, I have a lot of information about the topic, much more than an hour that I could fill. So I want to make sure that I am covering what you find important in your quest. So we talked about, you know, finding that therapist, getting word of mouth, looking at websites, looking at your insurance list. And there are some questions that are really important to ask when you first interview the therapist that you're going to meet with. And here are just a few of them. Ask them what their license is, if they're a psychiatrist, psychologist, MFT, pastoral counselor. Find out what their license degree is and what their level of education is. Ask them what their areas of expertise are. For MFTs, we have extra training when it comes to working with marriage and communication and families and parenting and children. So find out what that area of expertise is for the person you're going to see. Maybe they work with PTSD. Maybe they work with trauma, grief, attachment issues. So if you have a sense of what area you'd like to work with, if you are struggling with trauma or PTSD or grief, it's really important to find someone who you can align with and can have some sense of your struggle and some training in that area. Ask them how long they've been in practice. And again, here's where I take flack from my students who, you know, I give them a hard time about getting life experience before they think they're going to get a degree and go out and practice being the key on people who are older or have different life experiences or are in places that as a student they've never experienced. And as much as we as a profession would like people to think that once you've been trained, it doesn't matter how old you are, you can work with anyone of any gender, of any background, of any experience, and do the work because it's just about tools and holding space, that's not true. I think that's one of the greatest misperceptions or bad stories we tell as a profession, that it does make a difference, the amount of time people have spent on the planet, their experience, their life experiences, what they've gone through themselves, what they have mastered or conquered. We like to say that a therapist can only take a client as far as they've gone themselves. We can only help our clients move as deeply as we've gone ourselves. And so for someone who's straight out of school, right into the master's program, right out into the world, I am always concerned how far they're actually going to be able to take someone if they haven't had that life experience. So if you're thinking about, you know, marital relationships, you might want to ask your counselor, are they married or divorced? What are their feelings about marriage? If you're someone who wants to stay committed to your marriage, I worry about going to someone whose only experiences have been through divorce, because then what is their model for a healthy marriage? If you're struggling with your children and needing help with that, going to someone who's never had children can be a challenge, because what we understand about children in theory, on paper and through research, is much different than what we experience with children when we're actually raising them. Ask the counselor if they've struggled with mental health issues of their own. I know these may seem like personal things to ask a counselor, but you're talking about someone who's ultimately going to be in a very intimate relationship with you, and you really need to make sure that they are capable of holding the issues and the space and the experience that you are going to share with them and be able to give you the room and the space to find those answers for yourself. 805-781-3875. Hi, Robin, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, what I have to say goes hand in hand with what you have said about not allowing a counselor to take someone by the hand and lead them where the counselor wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important for a therapist not to lecture, but to ask questions, to take the client, the patient, to discover the things about themselves and their situations that they need to focus on and work on.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a challenging thing, again, because I think many therapists go into the work because they want to tell people how to do it better, in many ways better than they themselves are able to do it, you know? And I think that starts to become that fine line of being helpful and actually being harmful when it comes to working with people. Because the original... Go ahead.
I think that people that are already vulnerable, that lecturing them is not going to be very efficient.
And have you had an experience with therapy that was positive?
Yes, I have. I had therapy about 30 years ago. I was eventually diagnosed as being dysthymic or having depression. And I had a therapist. I was like your one caller that found someone on the first try that I got along with and that knew how to pull out of me the issues that I was dealing with, and it was very positive and very helpful.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the things that I feel is missing so much from our contemporary mode of counseling is the good old-fashioned Carl Rogers humanistic approach, which was seeing our clients as being fully capable of resolving their own issues and not needing to be told what to do or led, as you said, to what to do, but really allowing our clients to tell their story in such a way that they come up with their own solutions or their own answers. And that's kind of the original talk therapy model, aside from Freud, which was more of a medical-based model. But we moved to this humanist Carl Rogers form of listening to the clients and allowing them space to tell their story, that's where that healing, that self growth was really able to happen, because clients left feeling like they could now take on any issue because they'd come up with answers to the problems that brought them into therapy. Is that about where you're going?
Right, and that's where the sensitivity of the therapist is really all important, because they may make an observation about what is bothering a person or what direction they need to go or what they need to observe about themselves. But it's better to model it in the form of a question, mm-hmm. to lead the person, like you're saying, to come up with their own answers. It's empowering.
It is. And that's ultimately what we want, is to work ourselves out of business, right? We want our clients to not have to come back, but to leave with the sense that they've got this now. Thanks for the help. I've got this.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin. Thank you for calling. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist, 805-781-3875. You know, therapists primarily work to help individuals to better understand and cope with their thoughts and feelings and behaviors. And we're there to provide guidance and to help improve an individual's ability to reach their personal goals for growth or healing and recovery, but we're not really there to give those answers or to direct our clients. We're there to provide the space for our clients to talk about their feelings and thoughts and issues and behaviors, and to see where their unused opportunities are, or maybe their cognitions, the way they're thinking about an issue might be off, to kind of help them tell their story in a way that makes more sense to them. You know, as counselors, we assist people in developing life skills and improving relationships, and we help them to facilitate better ways of thinking and living day to day. We're really facilitators or conduits or space holders, is what I keep going back to, this idea of holding space. And what does that really mean? You know, it's not just about having a room with a couch that people can come sit on. It's the space is important, the physical space with chairs and a clock and, you know, nice mood lighting. But holding space is really, are you as a counselor able to hear the darkest feelings, the darkest depths of another soul and just allow them to experience without putting our own experience into the story or telling our own version of our own life, but to really just allow our clients to explore their experience. And so often what happens with therapists is they shortcut the work and want to jump in and say, yeah, I've heard this before, or I know exactly how you're feeling, or I know what you need to do. Here's what I did in the past, or here's what I've, thought, or here's what research says. And as soon as a therapist jumps in and co-opts the session and starts directing because they think they know what the client needs, they completely strip the client of the opportunity to build their own sense of strength and awareness and empowerment. And that's where I feel we've really lost our way, is that we've become empowered as a profession to see ourselves as experts and to have clients come in. And because we only have 8 to 10 sessions, we don't let the stories unfold. We jump in, we assume, we direct. And that's where we set our clients up for more trouble in the long run. Chris, thanks for calling in. Hi. What's on your mind today?
I just had a fantastic experience many years ago. I think it was 1985 with a therapist, and she helped me so much. And I thought that the way that she did it, the thing that seemed to work for me, was we talked about my issues and my problems, and she somehow managed to give it a different viewpoint. She managed to let me see things I hadn't thought of before about the situation. It was very successful. I moved away. It was also relatively inexpensive. I couldn't believe. I was looking back through my record the other day how inexpensive it was. And then recently, within the last 2 years, I went to another therapist to try to work with some of the issues I was having at that time, which were really bothering me a lot. They were intense. I was really looking for somebody to really give me some insight. And I went to 2 sessions with this one therapist, and she never told me anything new. She made me talk the whole time. And she said to me that we were going to have to spend the first several sessions just getting to know each other. Mm. And I thought that was very strange.
So you were hoping for more dialogue and interaction.
Help, yeah.
Yeah. So you wanted something concrete in the moment, like leave with some homework or something I can do.
Something to get my wheels going. Maybe she thought that by just talking it out, that was going to help me.
Well, it's interesting because that's very old school humanist, clinician style, which is, yeah, I'm just here to allow you to talk. And if you're inspired, something's going to click for you and you'll go do the work outside. It might have been a little too hands off, but I think there is that dance between, I want you to come in, tell your story, and hopefully I'm going to respond enough that you hear, as you said before, a new spin, a new take on it, if I'm hearing you correctly, right? Like, if I'm hearing you correctly, Chris, what you enjoyed about the first therapy was that this person reflected back to you the story you were telling her so you could hear it in a new way.
Yeah, pretty much.
And what didn't work with the second therapy is that there was no reflecting about what you said. It was just as if you were talking into a vacuum.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure that she reflected it back, but she obviously reflected on it herself and sent me some good feedback. Yeah,
absolutely. I appreciate you calling in because I think that, again, that clicking, that chemistry is so important.
Yeah, there was very little to choose from. I think at this time I was trying to go through the insurance companies, and I think it was the only one available to me locally, so I didn't have any choice, so I gave up. And I still have issues. I'd love to find a good therapist like I found back in 1985, but I don't have the stress issues that I had when I was looking for one 2 years ago. So I guess I'll just keep thinking about it. I'll keep listening.
And this is a good time, as I mentioned before, that when we're not in the crisis time, this is a great time to look for someone that you connect with, because having a good therapist is like having a good dentist or a good, pediatrician or a good physician, that someone you can trust in your moment of need. But we tend to wait to look for a therapist when we're overwhelmed, and that can cause us trouble.
And I'm also unsure about how to look for a therapist, so I think I need to listen more closely to what you've just been talking about.
Okay, good. Thank you for calling in, Chris.
Thank you very much for your time. I really love listening to you.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in. So let's talk about some of the different treatment approaches that therapists have, because we do have different theoretical orientations. Currently, there are 250 different approaches to counseling and counting. And I'm going to tell you just a few of the more popular. The most common current form of counseling today is cognitive behavioral therapy. And cognitive behavioral is a short-term, solution-focused way of working with clients to help change their thinking, to alter their behavior. behavior and feelings. The idea behind it is that our feelings aren't caused by external events. Our husband being annoying does not make us angry, but our thoughts about the event are what causes our reactions and behavior. So if your husband is being annoying and you find it's annoying, and your thoughts about this is that he's trying to make me crazy, or he's trying to make me angry, he's trying to make me upset, then your reaction is going to be that of someone who assumes they're being provoked. And so that's going to up or escalate the issue. And so in cognitive behavioral, we try to help change those or work with those persistent patterns of negative thinking. We have maladaptive, thinking patterns about certain situations, and if we can see them differently, then we will tend to behave and react differently. If we change our thinking, it will change our behaviors. So for another example, if you're struggling with the self-esteem issues or body image issues, and one of your friends says, "Oh, you look really nice today." If you're in a good space, you're feeling good about yourself, you might think, "Yeah, I do look good today. Thanks for noticing." But if you're struggling with body image issues or self-esteem and your friend says you look nice, and then your thought is, "Oh, she's just saying that because she's my friend and she has to," when you get caught in persistent patterns of negative thinking, that every time someone says you look nice, your self-talk is, "They're just being nice," or "No, I don't look good," or "I'm really struggling." When we get into these negative spirals, right, these consistent patterns of behavior, then we start changing our relationships, how we respond in our relationships. So cognitive behavioral is our most common. It's short term. We can address things like anxiety issues, things that we have fears about or worries about, relationship issues. So that's kind of our go-to. The struggle with cognitive behavioral is that it doesn't really address long-term change or psychic change on a deep level. It's really kind of focused on the here and now, as is behavioral therapy, which kind of approaches when we work with children's behavior issues, parenting issues, phobias, fears. Those are kind of in line with behavioral therapy. Then there's the systemic approach to therapy, and I'm a systems therapist really by training and my outlook. And systems therapists look at problems as they exist in the context of the framework they're living in, their family system, their marital system, their cultural system that they live in, their community, and how does the experience of being a part of that system impact the way we function as an individual? And so for systems therapists, we believe that problems are created and kind of sustained by the interactions we have with people in our system. How our relationship is with our parents or with our brothers and sisters, or the roles we played in that family, the behaviors that we acquired being a member of a family, or the behaviors we acquire being a member of a community, those impact our relationships outside of that system, how we behave outside of our family, how we behave in new relationships. And the idea in systems is that our patterns of behaviors are replayed throughout our life in every relationship we have. And so in order to kind of make change, we have to change the system. In a family, we have to change how people communicate with each other or the roles that people play. What we also see is that patterns of behavior are passed down through systems. If you grow up in a family of divorce, you have a higher chance of going through a divorce yourself, or alcoholism or drug addiction are passed down through systems because we learn our behaviors and our reactions through that system. There is also the humanistic approach we talked about, kind of the classic talk therapy, where we focus on the individual and their story, and narrative therapy is a reworking of how we see ourselves and kind of reframing that story to something that's more positive, more productive. We have attachment therapy, which is very current, very popular. It's kind of the bringing together of the research, both empirical and neurobiological, that supports what we actually saw on systems therapy, that our issues that we struggle with as adults in our relationships can reliably be predicted from what we saw in early patterns of attachment between parents and children. And so attachment therapy works on re-establishing close attachments with either our partner or with our parents if they're children. And then I really want to finish up talking about my favorite branch of the therapeutic field, and that's expressive arts therapy. Because expressive arts therapy is not as appreciated as it should be for how incredibly quick it is in helping people to work through deep grief, spiritual, existential crisis, life transitions, relationship issues. Expressive arts therapy is working with art through painting, drawing, sculpture, drama, dance therapy, music therapy. These different expressive arts therapies are all great paths to connecting with our unconscious. Most of the things we struggle with are trapped deep inside of us, and they don't have words. They're not associated with words. They are, more associated with kind of experiences that we had that we stuffed away. And when we draw or act or dance or create music, we allow those feelings to come up through the experiences non-verbally. And children especially thrive in play therapy and art therapy. I would much rather see children always go to play therapists who are trained to do play therapy than a child psychologist who's trained to do assessments about behaviors. Because children, 99% of the time, just need to work through some kinks of growing up, right? They're unformed. And so to have the opportunity through play and dance and drama therapy, children heal very quickly. But as adults, I encourage you to look into different associations, the play association or the art therapy association, and look for counselors who do that work, because it'll get you away from that medical model of seeing mental health as a disease-based issue and more of a spiritual, psychic-driven way of dealing with the psyche. Effective counseling is a two-way street. It requires two people working hard to come to a certain goal or competency or new version or understanding of life. And so set realistic goals, set a time frame, do your homework, find the person you have chemistry with, leave therapy that is not helpful, but don't leave therapy because it's uncomfortable, right? If you leave just because it's uncomfortable, then you might be leaving right when you're actually starting to do the work. Because really good therapy actually will cause you to feel worse before you feel better. Because when we finally open the doors to things that we struggle with, then we start to really feel those feelings. But when we go into that place and allow our feelings to come up, whether it's anger, disappointment, sadness, frustration, that feeling worse will give way to feeling better. And so good therapy is three parts: that building of the relationship, creating some sort of goals and assessment, and then the work part is part two, where we get lost between those two worlds of coming in for therapy as who you are, and then finding your way to that new self, and then finally the closure of therapy and the maintenance. And so if you have more questions, I encourage you to give me a call next week, 805-781-3875. We will continue this conversation because I think it's a big one. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And you can also podcast through iTunes, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. As always, I appreciate you supporting Public Radio KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Enjoy your afternoon.